I would rate my 2 years in Pakistan as perhaps the most exciting period of my career. I went to the Soviet Union. When I came back, it was collapsed into 15 parts. Mm. So some of my friends often hold me responsible for breaking it up. Foreign policy needs to be nimble. Sometimes you need to make the point gently, sometimes forcefully. Somewhere around perhaps 2008-10, the US unipolar moment ended in a world where you don't have a global policeman telling you what to do. So countries come together for conversations on issues. India wishes to be on the high table. India is an important voice. It cannot be ignored.
Hello and welcome. My name is Anupam Kher. Welcome to my show, where for the next half an hour, we will discuss all things India, Bharat, with a very special guest. He's a prominent diplomat and has served in various capacities, including as the High Commissioner to Pakistan and Canada. Welcome, Ajay Bisaria ji.
Thank you very much, Anupam ji. Great to be here.
Ajay Bisaria is a former Indian diplomat with a career spanning over 3 decades. He holds a bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Delhi and earned an MBA in Calcutta. He later got a second master's in public policy from Princeton. His first posting was in Moscow in 1988. Mr. Bisaria has served as India's ambassador to Poland and Lithuania. He's also served as the High Commissioner to Canada and as India's last High Commissioner to Pakistan, with his tenure overseeing a particularly challenging period of relations between New Delhi and Islamabad. Ajay Bisaria speaks several languages and is an avid yogi. His first book was published earlier this year.
Were you always wanting to be a diplomat?
Right, but first of all, great to be here. I've seen you in the movies, so great to see you in person. I've admired your movies, and I often feel that diplomats should learn acting, because often you need to act in the global stage.
I think they do a great job.
Yeah. You know, I had it at the back of my mind. Hmm. Because my father was in the government, so I wanted to explore being in the government. I did do an MBA. I explored possibly doing other careers. Mm. But then what attracted me to government and the foreign service was to be part of the India story and to work on a larger canvas. Mm. Because I had a sense, even early in my 20s, that, you know, the India story is going to be a good one, and it would be exciting to be part of India's journey in a more direct way by being part of government.
You were first posted in the Indian embassy in Moscow back in 1988. And since then, you have had an impressive career. How was it like being there? I believe you speak Russian.
I do. I do speak some Russian. Okay. And I, in fact, went my first posting in the Foreign Service. We are obliged, it's mandatory to learn a foreign language. And mine was Russian. So I went to Moscow University for a year. My job was to learn the language, which I did.
In how much time did you learn language?
Well, it's an immersion course that we did. So at about 8 or 9 months, I acquired a good deal of fluency. And then we learn off the streets. So, you know, you're immersed in that background. So I did speak the language fairly well. So it was, again, a very interesting time, because I was posted in Moscow in my formative years in diplomacy from 1988 to 91.
How many years were you there in Moscow?
So I was there 3 years, one of which I spent learning the language and the other two, you know, working at the embassy in the political wing, in the economic wing. And I went to the Soviet Union. When I came back, it was collapsed into 15 parts. Mm. So some of my friends often hold me responsible for breaking it up.
I believe you were born in Srinagar. What is the story behind it?
I guess I just chose my parents well. They happened to be in Srinagar when I was born. So it was, my father was on a transferable job. And I was born in Srinagar because he was managing All India Radio as an engineer in Srinagar. So I was born there. And it so happened that I moved from there to Mumbai at the age of 3. Okay. And I had no memories of Srinagar and Kashmir. But I did go there much later, when I was already in service. So I couldn't go there through the terrorism years. Only in this century, I got an opportunity to revisit the place of my birth.
And Your parents before that were pre-partition in Pakistan.
No, it so happened that my mother, as a child, went and stayed in Lahore because my grandfather was posted there. Okay. For a couple of years, around 1942. So that was just her experience in going to school in Lahore. And but the family belonged very much to India. They were from Uttar Pradesh.
What are the stories they used to tell you of pre-independence, pre-partition of Pakistan?
Yes, so my mother had some very interesting stories to tell. 1942 is her clear memory of the Quit India movement. She would see the processions of Bharat Chodo, and she never heard about Pakistan because, you know, the Pakistan Lahore resolution had been passed in 1940, but it wasn't a big thing. So in the 40s, in her story, she hadn't really heard of this concept of Pakistan. This she had gone to Lahore, India. And her happiest memories were of a trip the family took to Murree, the hill station, and they went to Abbottabad and traveled all over. So I often say that in the 40s, this was the most integrated region in the world. You could travel from Rangoon to all the way to Peshawar with no visas, and they were, so this is what her family remembers, that they could travel all over this vast land.
And then you became the High Commissioner of India and Pakistan, and in the most troubled times. In fact, there has been no High Commissioner after your tenure. So how were you dealing with it?
Yes, you know, so I would rate my 2 years in Pakistan as perhaps the most exciting period of my career, because you know, working in a conflict environment is always a challenge, and but it's also very exciting, and it raises many diplomatic possibilities. I was there 2 years, and one of the paradoxes of an Indian diplomat in Pakistan is that during the day there is a fair deal of hostility, but in the afternoon you could be meeting with diplomatic colleagues, and there's a good deal of friendship. And in the evening, over glasses of wine or whiskey, you are very friendly with common people or people who have got nothing to do with government. So that is a paradox, that there is such a good deal of hostility, but also such a good deal of friendliness and this cultural affinity of speaking the same language, liking the same food, and so on. So I think this paradox defines a diplomat's role in Pakistan. I also went through a tough and hostile period, and I think that is where some degree of creative diplomacy is required, because even at a time when the host government is very against your parent government, some doors are open to have quiet conversations and quiet diplomacy and to understand what is happening.
What do you think is the basic problem of Pakistan with India?
If you ask me to name one factor, I would say it's Pakistan's identity crisis. That while India, at birth, very rapidly developed an identity, developed a constitution within 3 years of independence and had the benefit of leaders with some continuity, Pakistan did not have the same good fortune. Its early leaders passed away. Jinnah died in 1948. Liaquat Ali Khan, the first prime minister, passed away in 1951. And Pakistan could not develop a constitution for itself till much later. So even it developed a constitution in 1956, but that was abrogated by 58 when Ayub Khan, the military dictator, took over. So the central problem became the capture of Pakistan by the elites, in this case the army elites, who have captured the country and continue to rule it for all these decades and have distorted what Pakistan could have become, in my view. So I think this is a fundamental structural problem that Pakistan faced, that it became an abnormal country run by an army elite which was intent on promoting its own interests rather than the interests of the people.
And yet, I will say that in the last few years, there has been no major terrorist attack in the last 10 years, to be very precise.
What has changed for us? You would recall from the 90s, terrorism became a major issue. First, in fact, from the 80s, first in Punjab, then 90s in Kashmir, from the 2000s all over India, and we never had a very good answer for it. We would, not react perhaps with force. Mm. And even after going nuclear in 1998, even in 2008, India did not react strongly to the Mumbai attack. What has changed now is that we have a different posture of active defense. There's certainly an effort to strengthen ourselves from within, which means have strong counter-infiltration, counter-terrorism grids within Jammu and Kashmir, for instance, to prevent terrorists from coming in, but also a proactive or active defense posture, which means you're willing to take the battle across borders in hot pursuit of these terrorists. In 2016, reacting to Uri, it was reinforced in 2019 when, after the Pulwama attack, the Balakot airstrikes took place. So now, here was an India that was setting up strategic deterrence or deterrence against terrorism. The message was that if terrorist incidents of a certain scale take place, India will again cross the border and react. So for the Pakistan Army, the policy of mounting terrorism, which was a low-cost policy, now became an expensive business, because now it was clear that if you launch an attack, the retaliation would be such that you could go to war, would have to react. So there was a certain cost. And that certainly is part of the reason that there's been a dramatic drop in cross-border terrorism. It's not been eliminated. It's taken on different forms. But there has been a significant drop. And I think that is an achievement of government resolve to address this question in a clear-headed way.
Why do you think the earlier governments were not interested in abrogating Article 370?
Well, I think certainly for the BJP, it was on the manifesto, it was on the cards. And it was certainly a goal to be achieved. But even the BJP NDA government could not achieve it in the earlier avatars in Vajpayee's government.
Yes.
Because it was an NDA government, it was a coalition government, there was a coalition common minimum program of the NDA, and this was not a priority. But I think there was clarity even in Vajpayee's mind and in other leaders' minds that once there would be a majority, it gave the opportunity to have Article 370 abrogated. And I think it was a decision that was waiting for a moment that a party had a clear majority and a clear strategy. I think integrating Jammu and Kashmir was a very important move. And more than that, having a strategy of counter-terrorism, counter-infiltration to ensure that after the Article 370 moves, there were no bloodshed on a large scale. Because as you would recall, there was a conversation that if Article 370 would be removed, there would be rivers of blood in Kashmir. But none of that happens because it was well planned, well executed. And I think by the benefit of hindsight of the last 5 years, certainly a successful policy, both in terms of stabilizing the state of Jammu and Kashmir and in terms of giving a clear answer to cross-border terrorism.
Yeah, because I come from the same area and I feel that it has benefited the people of Kashmir. The businesses, the employment, the infrastructure has helped. And yet when Article 370 was tabled in the parliament, there was a total opposition from certain section of people.
Yeah, I think it was a political conversation. And that was a political move, because Article 370 was more, the move on it was more than just a political move. It was also linked to security, foreign policy, and I think it served all those interests when we finally got it done. And I think now there's a reasonable consensus in the country that it was a good move, and that now we move to the next stage, perhaps, of the healing touch in Jammu and Kashmir. So rapidly moving towards stability and normalcy.
So that brings me to the next question. After this term, Prime Minister Modi will be the second longest serving PM of India. Is this continuity good for India on the foreign policy front?
Certainly is. We are now living in an age of a very turbulent world. Mm. Much is changing in the world. There are conflicts. Mm. Moving towards a multipolarity. And therefore, foreign policy needs to be nimble. Mm. So I think this government has been successful in very nimbly negotiating the world and improving India's heft and stature. Prime Minister Modi has External Affairs Minister Jaishankar, who understands the game and plays it very well. And the personal chemistry that the Prime Minister himself enjoys with this continuity, that's a corollary advantage of it, that you develop personal chemistry and personal relationships with world leaders. Mm. And that helps you as well. And it helps that now he's representing a $4 trillion economy with a huge kind of heft in the world in economic terms. So as an example, the West Asia relationships in what is called the Middle East, with the UAE, with Saudi Arabia, those are some new innovations in Indian policy. Mm. That the closeness of that relationship helps India in multiple ways.
And you've said that Indian diplomats are more confident in the Modi era. Why do you feel that?
They represent a country that is more confident.
That's right.
They represent a country where the leadership is consistent in giving a certain message to the world, to the people, and they have clearer instructions. And it helps that, you know, India's own power is growing. India's heft is such that India's voice is heard on the high table globally, whether you're talking about climate or trade or the global order or the G20. So I think all that helps for a clear message to go to the diplomats to act with confidence and to be able to, represent an India that is more confident.
In one of your opinion pieces, you wrote about a multipolar world and India wanting to become a pole. How much has Foreign Minister Jaishankar already done that for that goal?
I think he has, and I think India has. Because, this process has gone on, I would argue, since the 90s. Mm. Because 90s, after the Soviet Union collapsed, we moved from a bipolar world to a unipolar world where the U.S. was the only act in town. Mm. And somewhere around perhaps 2008-10, the U.S. unipolar moment ended, and we are moving towards a new order which might be multipolar. And India is making the point that in the future, as an aspiring power, we would like to be a pole. Mm. We wouldn't like a world which lapses back into being a bipolar world with China and Russia aligned against the West, or a world where India's voice is not heard. Mm. So I think we have been very active in terms of taking the G20 as an example. Mm. That is an is a body which tries to speak for the world in which economics matter, the major economies matter, and essentially make the point that in this world, the way it is going in the future, the major economies like India need to have a strong say in the direction in which it is moving.
So how important are formats like BRICS and SCO for a multipolar world?
I think they are important, and I think what has happened in this multipolar world is that you have newer formulations like BRICS, SCO. There's an alphabet soup of others like I2, U2 in West Asia and so on, the Quad. So these are all issue-based coalitions. So they come together in a world where you don't have a global policeman telling you what to do. So countries come together for conversations on issues. Now, BRICS, for instance, came together for a conversation on economic issues for the middle powers, the five middle powers that it represented. So I think that is the kind of world we will move to. countries will have issue-based alliances. Some of them will stay, some of them will fade away. And we will question this world order, which is presided over by the United Nations, which we feel hasn't delivered enough in terms of providing peace and security to the world. So alternatives will emerge, but we don't know which way it's headed, except that we know that India should have a say in it.
The way Foreign Minister Jaishankar now conducts, or now is so open about his point of views, which makes us proud. We never used to have somebody who will say, who will call them out. Is that a deliberate attempt to do that, or it's a personality trait of our foreign minister?
I think it's both. It certainly represents the new India, which is making its point to the world. Mm-hmm. And it's a confident new India, and therefore he is the voice often of that new India, and therefore he has to make the point about India's views. And
he's very articulate about it.
Absolutely. So sometimes you need to make the point gently, sometimes forcefully, sometimes in behind closed doors, sometimes publicly. So I think the point needs to be made, and the broader point that is emerging is that India wishes to be on the high table. India is an important voice. It cannot be ignored.
So the show is called Let's Talk Bharat. Where do you see India in the next decade?
Well, I think India is moving in a positive direction. Hmm. The stated objective of India is to bring prosperity to its people, right? We want to be a Viksit Bharat, a developed Bharat, a developed India by 2047. And what does that mean? That essentially means we need growth. We are growing at 6 to 8%. We possibly want to grow on a glide path of 8 to 10% and bring prosperity for our people. And our foreign policy will be oriented towards leveraging the world to facilitate this rise of India. It'll be a peaceful and benign rise in Asia as compared to the belligerent rise of China, say. But it will be something that will be good for the world. And I think, therefore, India will get more partnerships, deeper partnerships. India will engage in a multi-aligned way with Russia, with the Western powers, with Quad, and maximize the economic benefits for itself, but also be a force for stability in the world.
Great. So what are your future plans?
Well, I've just written one book, and I've been talking about it in different fora.
And this is the book which is called Anger Management.
That's right. It's called Anger Management, and it's been released this year. And it's essentially a story of the India-Pakistan relationship, and in a sense, any hostile relationship, but told through the prism of diplomacy, or from the eyes of diplomats, not just my experiences in Pakistan, but also of my 24 predecessors who were high commissioners or ambassadors from India to Pakistan from 1947 till 2017 when I went there. I hope to write another, and I'm working as a corporate consultant. I moved to the private sector, so I'm having a lot of fun doing that.
How much
that.
Time did it take you to write this book?
Well, it took me, I would say, about 2 hours a day for 4 years.
Because it's a thick book.
It's 540 pages, and
that's the amount of movies that I've done in 40 years. 540
well,
exactly.
I see. Yeah. I see. Well, your oeuvre is much more impressive, because you know each movie would have had a lot of blood, sweat, and tears going into it. So, but you know, I enjoyed the process of writing this book and researching it with multiple footnotes. I hope to write another one, and I'm also a distinguished fellow at the Observer Research Foundation, so doing some research in trying to understand this world. Now that I'm out of government, I'm at a distance, so it's good to look at the world from a distance and comment on it rather than act in it.
Thank you, Mr. Ajay Bisaria.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
Great
so much.
Here.
And thank you for watching. Join me next week as we uncover a new layer in yet another debate, and let's talk Bharat. I'm Anupam Kher. Goodbye.